C+45. En route, destination, Birchwood, Colorado. Towards the end of the drive back to Birchwood, the agent known to the McCarthys only as Harris showed his gratitude for their cooperation once again by waking them in time to watch a late-night announcement from the White House. Joining them in the back of the vehicle, Harris held a large tablet computer at arm's length with Dan and Clark on either side of him. The video statement from President Slater was very brief and had been pre-recorded at her desk with no reporters present. In it, after confirming the already universally understood news that Comet Conte Abate no longer appeared to be heading for Earth, she publicly and personally absolved Dan McCarthy of any guilt anyone may have attributed to his secrecy regarding Richard Walker's hoax, while also vowing to launch a full investigation into the events surrounding the hoax itself. She also told the nation, and indeed the world, that Dan had spent the day liaising with specialist personnel, and undergoing both physical and psychological testing following his extraordinary interaction with an extraterrestrial being. More details would be forthcoming, Slater said, but the long and short of it was that Dan's ultimately successful attempt to draw the messengers back to Earth and his equally successful attempt to persuade them to alter the comet's trajectory had quite literally safeguarded the immediate future of our planet. Dan could never truly like Slater after her actions of the previous year, but his position on that front was gradually softening. President Slater stopped tactfully short of speculating on what the day's events would mean for the GSC, but she did take a few seconds to acknowledge John Cole's earlier resignation as British Prime Minister, an incident which normally would have been the biggest thing to happen in any given month, but which had today been utterly cast aside by the breathtaking events which occurred in Birchwood just a few hours later. "It would be remiss of me not to mention John Cole's resignation," she said, working hard to conceal the smile that seemed determined to break out. "And I'd like to take this opportunity to express my support for the acting Prime Minister, Diane Logan, who many feel was unfairly replaced by Mr. Cole as Deputy Prime Minister prior to William Godfrey's move to the GSC. History sometimes has a way of correcting its mistakes, and in the potentially tumultuous weeks and months ahead, a steady hand and firm ally of the United States is exactly what the United Kingdom, and indeed the world, needs more than anything." It struck Dan as more than a little odd that Slater spent around a fifth of her time talking about a political story that he imagined hardly anyone in London was even talking about, given the epic-defining events at the drive-in. But he by now understood only too much about the charade of frontline politics and knew that Slater, like the rest, really did care more about getting one over on her rivals than she did about anything else. Slater signed off with a call back to her initial disclosure speech, which, despite having been issued under false pretenses, would never be a source of real embarrassment, given that every other world leader had also simultaneously issued their own. "A year ago," she said, "I signed off with the message that we may no longer be alone, but we will always be united. A year is a long time in politics, as today's developments in London have further underlined. But what today's developments in Colorado have underlined is that there is no may. We can no longer consider ourselves the only intelligent and technologically advanced race to have walked on Earth, and we can no longer consider ourselves the only intelligent race prone to altruistic empathy. Tonight, we will celebrate the intervention of those we know as the messengers. We will celebrate the news that Comet Conte Abate, christened Il Diavolo by its first human observers, will miss our planet entirely. But tomorrow, I hope, we will take a moment to learn from the messenger's example. Not every action has the desired result, and the knock-on effects of a good intention can be positively grave. But with the desire to do good, to enhance, to uplift, and to protect, there is no mountain too high, no valley too deep, and no comet too diabolical to overcome. The weeks since the comet's discovery have been more trying than any we can remember, but the resolve of this great nation and its fine citizenry has never wavered. We have made it through the darkest days and we have emerged stronger and more united than ever. Ladies and gentlemen, we are not alone, and because of that we are safe. We are united, we are together, and we are past the darkest days. Tonight, tomorrow, and always, may God bless America." Harris powered down the tablet as soon as Slater's statement concluded. No one reacted vocally to her words, which were fairly uncontroversial and would likely strike the right chord among most of the watching public. "We're almost back in Birchwood," he said, "and so you don't get any surprises, I should tell you that the town is essentially locked down. This isn't like last time with local cops and plastic barriers. This time, there are full roadblocks at the main entrance to Birchwood, and no private vehicles are getting in or out. No exceptions."
"So the roadblock is before the drive-in?" Clark asked.
"Yes, the drive-in is in Birchwood, after all. You'll see what I mean when we arrive."
Clark said. "In that case, could you guys drop us off in Colorado Springs instead? My car is on the wrong side of the roadblock, but Emma's is still parked at Fiore Frontieri."
"Do you have a key?" Dan asked.
Clark reached into his pocket for his own car key, which Harris had returned when he arrived with the tablet.
"Her spare is on here, and our spare is on hers."
"That should be fine," Harris said. Clark nodded and turned back to Dan.
"This way we'll have one car on each side of the roadblock, so whenever we need to go somewhere, we won't need to walk all the way from the edge of town."
Dan wasn't really listening, too focused on something else.
"Speaking of Fiore Frontieri," he said to Harris, "what's happening with the investigation into the explosion? Was it really those welcomer assholes?"
"Yes, to the best of my knowledge," Harris confirmed, "and I have been kept abreast of the developments. The renovation crew was compromised by a rogue individual who modified the chairs before moving them inside from the delivery truck and placing them on the stage, but the press room was fully fitted out several days ago, so the attack was intended for the first press conference in that room rather than the specific press conference you planned for yesterday morning. The device under Timo's chair was not remotely detonated when he sat down, as many in the media have been thinking. All three chairs were rigged to explode when a certain amount of weight was first placed upon them, but sloppy workmanship ensured that the first two failed. Without wishing to downplay what happened, it could have been a lot worse than it was."
"The IED did look like shit," Clark said. "Thank God for amateur hour, right?"
Harris lifted his phone from his pocket to check their current location and immediately knocked on the division between the large vehicle's front and back sections. He opened the doorway like hatch and informed the driver of the new drop-off point, which was less than a mile away. Then finally reunited the brothers with their phones.
"Your phones are fully functional," Harris said as he handed them over. "But all recent location-based data has been scrambled, which may affect the short-term performance of certain apps."
"I'll survive," Dan said.
Harris then offered his hand, first to Dan, and then to Clark.
"I wish I could say it's been a pleasure," Clark jibed as he shook it firmly.
"Well," Harris said, "if you ever want to join us again at Area 51, you know who to ask for."
Clark turned to Dan.
"See, it was Area 51.
"He's messing with you, man," Dan laughed. Harris laughed even louder and winked at Clark.
"It's been a pleasure."
Outside, the nighttime city air hit the brothers like a welcome splash of water on a hot summer's day, reinvigorating them after far too long cooped up in the back of the oversized SUV. The streets around the Fiore Frontieri headquarters, once the IDA building from which Richard Walker had tricked the world, were no busier or quieter than normal. The building itself was surrounded by a large cordon covered in police tape, with several lights shining from the inside, and two forensics vans parked as close as possible to the main doors. Emma's car, which she had parked on a nearby side street to enable an easy entrance and exit through the building's rear doorways, was safely clear of the cordoned-off parking lot. Clark clicked the key to remotely unlock the car, and Dan got inside first. The smell of Emma's perfume hit him so immediately and conjured up so many automatic thoughts and feelings that Dan's eyes closed of their own accord as his lungs inhaled deeply. Clark could smell the perfume, too, ridiculously strong in his opinion, and he knew it would mean something else to Dan.
5 more minutes, he said, checking his mirrors and hitting the gas. 5 more minutes, and we're there.